And I do have some printed out copies of that too. Okay, so today we're going to read, as I said, about the letter of Saint Ignatius of Antioch to the Romans. If you need a paper copy, I have, I think, 5 or 6 here. And I also send it to you by email. If you want, I see some people printed it, and you can follow on your phone or whatever. But that would be if you need a copy, I think copy is. Is there one more copy or? Okay. So it is emailed out. If you want to look at it on your phone too as well, PDF. So. Last week, and I think there are a handful of people here who were not here last week. So last week, we went over this period of history beginning with the book of Acts, beginning then with what immediately follows the book of Acts, which is the martyrdom of Peter and Paul under the Emperor Nero, probably sometime around 64 AD, maybe 68 AD, something like that. And then we learned last week as well about how Saint John, the Apostle John the Theologian, was the only one of the 12 who was not martyred. And he did not really go from place to place continuously as the other apostles did, but he settled much more. He settled in Ephesus, and where he founded something that could be more or less termed like a school, but almost kind of like a parish in a sense, or a community. And then we learned that there are several saints following after John who seem to be very much in line with John and possibly even studied with him. And Saint Ignatius of Antioch is one of those people, along with Saint Polycarp of Smyrna, Saint Irenaeus of Lyon, and a few others. So, Saint Ignatius of Antioch, he is a hieromartyr, and that literally means, hiero means priest, and martyr, witness, but as of course we know what a martyr means anyway, but that literally means priest martyr, Ignatius of Antioch. And so he was a bishop. At that time, there was not a super strong distinction between what is a bishop and what is a priest. Anybody who was the head of a community of Christians was called a bishop. And I think some Protestant groups have kind of reclaimed that kind of language nowadays. But back then, that's kind of how it worked. So he was a bishop. It's not clear if he was the bishop of all of the Christians in Antioch or if he was just the bishop of one of the Christian communities in Antioch. But anyway, at some point, he was taken in an imperial procession from Antioch to Rome. And it appears that what happened is the author, at least the editor of this book, which is the St. Vladimir Seminary Press edition, the author of this book, Alastair Stewart, who's a British person, and as we know, British people are experts on everything. he thinks that this was in the year 130, maybe 134, something like that. Some of the ecclesiastical tradition thinks it's a bit earlier than that. But he says that this this was with the emperor, I can't remember which one, Trajan maybe, who was fighting on the Eastern Front and was returning. He was returning to Rome, and his whole retinue, his whole army was returning back. And it seems that they took, for whatever reason, it's never really made clear, but for some reason they took St. Ignatius to be a martyr in Rome, and they're going to throw him to the wild beasts. If you've seen the movie Gladiator with Russell Crowe, you have a good idea of what that looks like. I think that movie actually historically captured it very well. At least that's what I've heard. I mean, the history is different. The history of what they're showing is different, but at least how the Colosseum was and everything. So St. Ignatius, the whole theme of everything he's doing is talking about this impending martyrdom. He's talking about this impending martyrdom. And in this way, he's kind of an intentional imitator of Paul. You know, Paul talks about his death a few times. You know, he talks about, you know, it is better for me to depart and be with Christ, but, you know, maybe God will let me be with you guys longer. You know, so St. Paul is always kind of conscious of this fact that, you know, what he's doing, going around and upsetting a lot of people by preaching the gospel, is, you know, going to lead to his death, very likely. And it did. And in St. Ignatius's case, he knows that it is leading to his death, his being a Christian bishop is leading to his death. So, you know, I'm just going back to this point here about him being a bishop. It seems that he was the bishop of the whole city of Antioch. Again, some authors say that. Some authors say he was just a bishop of one community. In the church tradition, I think of him as the bishop of the whole city by that point. And he has this model of priests, bishops, priests, and deacons. So his writings are kind of the earliest source where it breaks down this model of, like, the ecclesiastical ranks are bishop, priest, deacon. St. Paul uses all these terms, of course, but he doesn't kind of have it as like a hierarchy of bishop, priest, deacon, as these different ranks of clergy. So this is the first place where that comes in. So, yes.
I mean, those terms you're using are sort of the hierarchy of the church through time,
yes,
right?
To today.
But it was started as a... So you're saying he was the originator, or that imitating Paul, he was...
He was the first one to use the terms in a form that are recognizable to what we have.
The first person who writes something down isn't always the person who came up with it. It's just the first person who writes it down.
Or the like.
Exactly.
So it may have been an effect. In other words, it wasn't a committee that sat down and said, this is where we're going to structure our church.
And then the evidence seems that in different cities it evolved differently. So, like, part of the reason why Rome is so big about the Pope is because very early on they set up a bishop of all of the different communities of Rome. They had to, because there were a lot of debates there. And so they didn't really do it that early on, but they did it earlier than some other places. And it's because of all the conflict there. So generally, what happened is that the more heretics there were in a place, the faster they would go to this model of being like, okay, we need at least one guy who's in charge of the canonical Christians here. And that's kind of how it developed. But to be honest, we don't really know all that much exactly of how it developed, but we know that, you know, by the time of Constantine, and even earlier than Constantine, there was a very clear, it was basically exactly what we have today.
Okay.
By the time of Constantine, in terms of you have a bishop in a big metropolis somewhere, and then all these smaller towns, you just have a priest.
So it was more or less born out of necessity, that model.
But the terms are as still following how St. Paul uses them. And, you know, it's good to remember, too, I mean, this priest comes from presbyter, which means elder. Bishop means overseer, episkopos, which is overseer. And deacon is diakonos, which means servant. So these were, and these terms all come from the household slave terms, actually. So, like, the head slave in a household was called the episkopos or the economos. The presbyters, maybe not from the slave model as much, but diakonos as well. This literally could just be translated slave. So I don't think Deacon Spiridon, when he comes here on Sunday, we should call him Slave Spiridon. That wouldn't be very nice, but that's literally what it means, you know, or servant, slave or servant. But actually, you know, when we when we give communion, we say the servant of God in Greek. At that point, they don't use diakonos, they use doulos, which like definitely means slave. That definitely means slave, without any ambiguity. So really, at communion, we could be saying the slave of God, but again, it just sounds weird in English. So we don't. But So St. Ignatius, you know, he writes 7 letters. His language, he's really trying to imitate St. Paul, as we will see as we get into the letter. So, let's see here. I have kind of an outline here. And so, let's just go through kind of these big concepts. These are some of the concepts that we will see as we read through. I imagine some of you read through it already, but, you know, we'll sit through and read through it again. He refers to himself as a prisoner, as one bound, as one in chains. St. Paul does this a lot in his letters. And so St. Ignatius, he's really trying to imitate St. Paul. And you might think, oh, he's just trying to do that to make himself seem so great. Well, it's not that. What he's doing is, he thinks that St. Paul is the model Christian. St. Paul is the model Christian, you know? And we might forget that sometimes. But, you know, St. Paul is the model Christian. And so in St. Ignatius's eyes, he's saying, okay, I'm a bishop. I'm being martyred in a very public way. And I need to show people that, you know, I'm trying to be like St. Paul. But in his letters, he says, I'm not the same as them. You know, he says, they were apostles. I'm a condemned criminal, he says about himself. But, but the point of what he's doing, he's using some of this language so that he really emphasizes how he is bound, he's a prisoner, which is language that St. Paul uses, because about half of St. Paul's letters were written when St. Paul was in prison as well.
But doesn't St. Paul write in Timothy, imitate me?
Right, and so that's what we're
doing. His student, Timothy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he says, be an imitator of me. Yeah, and so that's
and in fact, what I we think do. That's as how Christians. We be. One of the ways we become Christian. One of the ways we live out our Christian calling is by imitating holy people, mm-hmm. and some of them are in this room.
God willing,
maybe a lot of them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, that's very true. I mean, that's why we have saints now. I mean, but if you look at that time, St. Ignatius was writing, they didn't have all these saints that we have. They basically had, you know, the apostles. Because he's the second generation, from the apostle, from Christ. And so he talks, of course, about his impending martyrdom. He talks about being called a Christian. And what does it mean to be a Christian? We see that in this letter as well. He makes a strong connection between the Eucharist and martyrdom. You know, he prays that through his martyrdom, he will become the pure bread, for Christ. And so we'll get into that, what that means, but, you know, we'll make sure to pay attention to that. Beginning to be a disciple in death, you know, that it's in death that we begin our Christian lives, in a sense. Death is the entrance into true life. And this is he doesn't say it in those exact words, but, you know, this idea that is very much in this letter to the Romans. Again, Eucharist and martyrdom, he brings this up again. He brings this up twice. The bread of God, the drink of God. So he puts this close connection between the Eucharist and martyrdom. And then the life of men versus the true life. So he juxtaposes, how we live to how people in the world live. Of course, that kind of language is very much in the Gospel of John. In the first letter of John, the Apostle John says, what is it? Friendship with the world is enmity toward God, I believe is how it's said. And so this is very strong contrast. And so St. Ignatius has that too as well. Okay, so at this time, I think we can just kind of go ahead and read here. So, the letter of Ignatius to the Romans, and this is the commentary from this book that I just copied, that I just put there. The editor, he says, unlike the other letters of Ignatius, which are directed to churches which he had visited on his journey from Asia to Rome, this letter is addressed to a church with which he had no personal acquaintance. Its purpose is primarily to introduce himself. Yet at the same time, Ignatius writes with full expectation and knowledge of his coming death. He is principally concerned in this letter to ensure that his martyrdom takes place and not be frustrated by any well-meaning attempt to save him. His martyrdom is to enact the Eucharist in the arena, to be an offering like that of Christ. Okay, so here we have... And why don't we go ahead, let's see here. Mark Kotz, why don't you go ahead and read the greeting.
Sure. Ignatius, who is also called Theophorus, or God-bearer, to the church which has obtained mercy through the majesty of the Most High Father and Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son, the church which is beloved and enlightened by the will of him that wills all things, and which are according to the love of Jesus Christ our God, which also presides in the place of the region of the Romans, worthy of God, worthy of honor, worthy of the highest happiness, worthy of praise, worthy of obtaining her every desire, worthy of being deemed holy, and which presides over love, is named from Christ and from the Father, which I also salute in the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father. To those who are united both according to the flesh and spirit, to every one of his commandments, who are filled inseparably with the grace of God and are purified from every strange taint, I wish abundance of happiness unblameably in Jesus Christ our God.
That's a long first sentence.
Yes. So you might think, looking at this long first sentence, you might, if it didn't say Ignatius, who was also called Theophorus, you might think it was a letter of St. Paul, right? I mean, just the way that he sets up his greeting, you know, naming the Father and Jesus Christ, and greeting people. Okay, so this is his greeting. There's not really much there to talk about too much, but I would emphasize one thing here. So he says, according to the flesh and spirit. In his letters, he really emphasizes flesh and spirit, and he talks about unity of flesh and spirit. And when we see him use that language, it's interesting because when he says spirit, he kind of basically means like doctrine or theology. And flesh, he means like works. So it's almost his way of saying like faith and works, but it's like flesh and spirit, and which the flesh corresponding to works and the spirit corresponding to faith. He doesn't get into that faith and works language, which of course caused many issues for Protestants later on. But he uses flesh and spirit, which kind of meaning the same thing. And of course, this is the belief in the New Testament and now that, you know, human beings are composed of flesh and spirit. I think we'll just pay attention to that flesh and spirit, and he also ties that into his theology of the Eucharist, which we will see. All right, Dr. Paul, how about you go ahead and read chapter 1?
As a prisoner, I hope to see that through prayer to God, I have obtained the privilege of seeing your most worthy faces and have ever been granted more than I requested. For I hope as a prisoner in Christ Jesus to salute you, if indeed it be the will of God that I be thought worthy of attaining unto the end. For the beginning has been well ordered,
If I may obtain grace to cling to my lot without hindrance unto the end, for I am afraid of your love, lest I should do me an injury. For it is easy for you to accomplish what you please, but it is difficult for me to attain to God, if you spare me.
Okay. So what is he talking about there? When he says, if I may obtain grace to cling to my lot, for I'm afraid of your love, lest it should do me an injury. What is he talking about?
Yes. Well, my thought on this was that he was certain to die.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And of the variety of deaths that the Romans had for people who caused civil unrest, which is probably what he was charged with, dying quickly in the arena is public and fast, and you know, and doesn't go on for hours or days, which would be some of the other possibilities. But they wouldn't be, it's very extraordinarily unlikely they could get him out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. And he does refer to that, how it's a quick death in the arena.
He's also trying to convince them not to stand in the way of his martyrdom.
Yeah, and that's what he gets into.
From that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He kind of repeats that. This idea that... so he actually says it would do me an injury. It would do him an injury that out of their love, they would try to save him. If it were a long, prolonged death, that would be maybe different, but this kind of, he's hoping, just to go in the arena, get eaten by the beasts, and that's it. You know, he's looking for this death.
Is he saying that he doesn't want them to intercede?
Yeah, and that they could try to use their influence, yeah, and do something, but he's saying, no, don't do that.
But he's saying, I can't attain God if you save me, if he doesn't die a martyr's death, he'll never get to God. Is that what he's saying there?
He's making that point. Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's saying that applies to everyone.
I hope not.
Yeah. But he's we shouldn't interpret it that way. But he's saying that, and we could say, he knows that he needs to die this death.
You know, he's the leader of a flock. If one of the lesser people in his flock were arrested, there would be no hope at all of anyone getting him off.
Right.
And, but because he has power and influence, we see this all the time, people
mm-hmm.
who have power and influence get a very different shake in the legal system than people who don't. And so he's, in this way, kind of making himself equal to the people that he serves.
Mm-hmm. That's actually exactly what we'll see with one of the ones I'm going to read next, which is the martyrdom of St. Polycarp, which is that his followers are like insisting that he goes and hides, basically. Because all the other Christians are like, oh, you're too important, you can't get martyred.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
One of the interesting novels I've read, one of the powerful novels I've read, is called Silence.
Mm-hmm.
By a Japanese author about the martyrdom about the martyrs of Japan during the time when Roman Catholic, especially the Portuguese Jesuits, were active in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest problems they encountered, and I wonder, I'm speculating now, really and that is that by your martyrdom, you don't want to cause other people harm. In other
mm-hmm.
words, I don't want to drag other people into torture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the cleverest things that the Japanese authorities used against Christians there, they took people and said, if you renounce Christ, I will release all these other people you will be responsible for torturing.
Mm. Yeah.
If you renounce Christ, these people live.
Right, right.
It was a an ingenious way of doing it, although Christians remain, there was a Christian presence and remain, although, like I say, it was Roman Catholic. I mean
right.
Let's understand it. It's a controversial novel, but Christians remained hidden.
Mm-hmm. No, I've heard about that, yeah.
And their presence remained. And, one of the difficult things about martyrdom is that the issue of our, of who else, you know, is this issue of not causing harm,
mm-hmm.
not causing suffering for others, I guess.
I think that could be what's going on here, because he does seem to think that he is strong enough to face it. But he says, "Pray for me that I persist until the end." But he seems to think, "Okay, I'm probably strong enough for it." But probably, what would happen is that if they came and tried to save him, they would try to martyr them too. Then maybe some of them would renounce Christ, and then it would be even worse. And so he's just trying to make a point.
Well, and he's, mm-hmm. I guess he's talking about his special calling.
Yes.
Everyone is called. I mean, some are called to be priests, some are called to be bishops, some are called to be deacons, some are called to be martyrs in this most obvious way. And only maybe in a metaphorical sense, we're all called to be martyrs. But in this specific way, at this specific time, in that historical setting, he felt God had touched him for a special mission.
He was called. Well, we'll see how he continues with that. So, chapter 2, could you go ahead,
mm-hmm.
Tara?
For it is not my desire to act towards you as one who pleases men, but as one pleasing God, even as also you please him. For neither shall I ever have such another opportunity of attaining to God, nor will you, if you shall now be silent, ever be entitled to the honor of a better work. For if you are silent concerning me, I shall become God's, but if you show your love to my flesh, I shall again have to run my race. Pray then, do not seek to confer any greater favor upon me than that I be sacrificed to God while the altar is still prepared, that being gathered together in love, you may sing praise to the Father through Christ Jesus, that God has deemed me, the Bishop of Syria, worthy to be sent for from the east unto the west. It is good to set from the world unto God, that I may rise again to him.
So here we're seeing some of this language where he's connecting the Eucharist, Eucharistic language, to his martyrdom. So when he calls what he refers to as the altar, I mean, what would that be, the altar, in this case?
The Colosseum, the place of sacrifice.
Yeah. I mean, the Colosseum. And so he's going to be poured out. We think of, you know, his blood being poured out, just as, you know, Christ says, this is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you. And in the same way, you know, Ignatius's his blood is being shed, is being poured out for Christ. So he's talking about, you know, the altar in this case. Where the sacrifice is taking place is the Colosseum. It's his martyrdom is the sacrifice. And when he talks about this, you know, when he says the Bishop of Syria worthy to be sent from the east unto the west, Syria was kind of on the eastern end of the Roman Empire, and so that's why he says east to west. He's coming from east to west, and then he kind of used this analogy of the sun. It is good to set from the world unto God, that I may rise again to him. So he's kind of using this idea that, you know, he's going toward a sunset from east to west.
Okay,
next.
Would you like to go ahead?
Pray rather that I may attain to martyrdom. You have never envied anyone. You have taught others. Now I desire that those things may be confirmed by your conduct, which in your instructions you enjoy on others. Only request that I may act both inward and outward with strength, that I may not only speak, but truly will, and that I may not merely be called a Christian, but really be found to be one. For if I be truly found a Christian, I may also be called one, and be then deemed faithful, when I shall no longer appear to the world. Nothing visible is eternal, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. For our God Jesus Christ, now that he is with the Father, is all the more revealed in his glory. Christianity is not a thing of silence only, but also of manifest greatness.
And so just as a point here, so when it has these brackets, that means that there's some ambiguity in the original Greek text that, you know, because there are different texts that have been preserved, and sometimes words are missing, and sometimes there are different words in place of other words, because the scribes who copied it over centuries and centuries and centuries might have changed a word by mistake or something. So so that's when it has these brackets like that. So we see, you know, he says, only request in my behalf both inward and outward strength, so saying, pray for me, that I may not only speak, but truly will, and that I may not merely be called a Christian, but really be found to be one. So he's, you know, he's saying here that a Christian, a follower of Christ, is, you know, he's saying that the most proper definition of a Christian, you know, is somebody who sacrifices their entire life, in his case, through martyrdom. So he's really be found to be a Christian, is what will happen when he's martyred. And then he says this interesting thing. He says, and then be deemed faithful when I shall no longer appear to the world. Nothing visible is eternal, for things which are seen are temporal, like temporary, but things which are not seen are eternal. So this is this, you know, this idea that, you know, we don't see God, and now that Christ has ascended, we don't see him with our eyes. But, and in the same way, you know, when the martyrs are martyred, you know, they're eaten up by the beasts or whatever, we don't see them. But then he says, you know, this is when, you know, Christ is all the more revealed. You know, he says, for our God, Jesus Christ, now that he is with the Father, i.e. not with us, not seen by us, he's all the more revealed. It's kind of a weird paradox, but it's, you know, it's that we, people didn't understand Christ until he ascended. We see even in the New Testament, it's very clear that, you know, when Christ was about to ascend, the apostles, they asked him, they said, okay, are you now going to restore the kingdom to Israel? They still didn't understand. You know, and it was only when he left and the Spirit came, when Christ disappeared and the Spirit came, that then they came to understand. And it's this weird paradox that, you know, when you see Christ, you don't understand him. You know, when Pontius Pilate was interrogating him, he didn't know he was talking to the Son of God. He thought, okay, this is just some Jew from Nazareth, you know, who's causing some trouble. And we have to think, too, you know, that if we were there, we tend to think, right? We tend to think, oh, if I had been there, I would have been there at the foot of the cross with, you know, those two other people, his mother and John. But there's a 99.9999999% chance you would not have been. I would not have been. None of us would have been.
There's at least 11 out of 12 chance that...
Yeah. Yeah, at least... Well, there's all the women followers and all the other... Well, it said they watched from a distance.
Well, I was just speaking of...
Yeah. Nothing visible is eternal. You know, things which are seen are temporal, but things which are not seen are eternal. So, you know... We don't, and this even would tie even into a kind of an argument about You know, we're told nowadays, you know, we all have to believe in science. And I mean, science is very good. It's very good to have science. It's very good to have all the things that science brings us. But, you know, if we only have science, then we would say, okay, God doesn't exist because we can't observe him. We can't see him. Because that's the scientific method. Science is a method. It's not much more. It's a method of observation and drawing conclusions. And if so, we would have to, you know, conclude, okay, God doesn't exist. So that's what he's saying. You know, the things which are seen are temporal. The things which are not seen, i.e. the things that cannot be observed scientifically, are eternal.
So when people have manifestations of saints or the Blessed Mother, whatever, we're seeing with our spiritual eyes rather than our temporal eyes?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. But I think, you know, sometimes with saints or with visions like that, there's kind of a breakthrough in a sense. But, yeah.
So, you know, I just feel, I love reading original letters. I mean, I know they've been translated umpteen million times.
Well, this one's more or less translated.
To find these words from, you know, it's mind-boggling to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their conceit of what was going on and their vision of the eternal,
mm-hmm.
is just so, like, where do we go
wrong? Yeah.
I mean, we still have it, but it's pretty advanced, I guess. You know? And
yeah.
It's trying to grasp it, you know. It's really amazing. I guess that's what that evokes for me, reading the actual words.
Mm-hmm. People at that time were they didn't have smartphones, so they were smarter than we are, right?
Yes.
They couldn't rely on technology. No, but they people. Yeah, it's easy to think that, well, because they had worse technology than us, they were less intelligent. And probably the masses, for lack of a better word, probably were extremely uneducated.
Yeah, but not less intelligent,
uneducated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even his management of his approach to martyrdom is so sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about marketing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to be facetious, but to be really on track of the true life,
mm-hmm.
true power,
and he's kind of just, you know, he's sending these letters out for posterity's sake, in a sense. I mean, you know, he's, and for these communities specifically, but also with the knowledge that, you know, I'm being martyred in a very public way. You know, I better write down, as you said, this very advanced kind of theology of martyrdom. That I have, it's really something. I really think that if we just, you know, if the evangelicals were to read this, they would change their mind about tradition.
I think their hair would start on fire.
Well, they don't accept it.
Yeah,
they call them apocryphal letters.
Right. Yeah. But it's a really amazing, though, because you're seeing the same theology as Paul and John and.
So
it would be nice if they would accept it. But yeah.
I'm curious, and maybe this is not a time to address it, but
mm-hmm.
just to have some comparison or some frame of reference for Ignatius of Antioch versus Ignatius of Loyola. Because for the longest time, I thought our saint was, you know, Ignatius of Loyola.
Yeah, the founder of the Jesuit order.
And I know that was later,
mm-hmm.
but so does Catholicism ignore?
Oh no, he's big in Catholicism.
He's Catholic.
Yeah, it's because he's pre-schism, right? So that's why.
Yeah.
More
yeah. The reason that the Protestants don't like it is the very structure you talked about in the beginning. You know, bishop, priest,
yeah.
deacon, you know, they don't like that
yeah.
hierarchical, you know, that being
right.
dictated.
And he says in some of his other letters, he tells people, like, listen to your bishop.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so that's...
Okay, so chapter 4. Lars, you want to read chapter 4?
Yeah, okay. Allow me to fall prey to my obedience. I write to the churches and impress on them all that I shall willingly die for God unless you hinder me. I beseech of you, do not show an unseasonable goodwill toward me. Allow me to become food for the wild beasts through those instrumentally it will be granted to me to attain God. I am the wheat of God, and let me be ground by the teeth of wild beasts, so that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. Rather entice the wild beasts, that they may become my tomb, and may leave nothing of my body, so that when I have fallen asleep in death, I may be no trouble to anyone. Then shall I truly be a disciple of Christ, when the world shall not see so much as my body. Entreat Christ for me by these instruments, that I may be found a sacrifice to God. I do not, as Peter and Paul, issue commandments unto you. They were apostles, but I am condemned. I am a condemned man. They were free, well, even now. Well, I am even now a servant, but when I suffer, I shall be the freed man of Jesus and shall rise again, emancipated in him. And now, being a prisoner, I learned not to desire anything worldly or vain.
Thank you. So there's a lot going on in this paragraph. I mean, the first part here is really, really beautiful. You know, allow me to become food for the wild beast. He says, I am the wheat of God, and let me be ground by the teeth of the wild beasts, that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. So, you know, just as Christ sacrificed himself, died on the cross, and then he says, this is my body and this is my blood, you know, the saints of this early period, they saw this connection, this very close connection between being a martyr for Christ and their bodies being like an offering for Christ. Now, they're not saying, okay, my body is communion. They're not saying that. Only Christ's body and blood are you know, holy communion. But they're saying that, you know, that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. So he's saying, you know, that it's in his martyrdom, it's the same thing as partaking of the Eucharist, in a sense. And that's, we lose that sense of partaking of the Eucharist. You know, when in the early church, when people were being martyred left and right, especially the leaders, the bishops especially, you know, they had this very strong connection of, you know, they, when they would come, they would do their form of the liturgy that they would do, you know, and they would partake of the body and blood of Christ. They had this in mind that what they were doing was, you know, partaking in martyrdom. You know, that they were partaking in Christ's own martyrdom, his witness to himself, his witness to God. And then also, you know, that it was, that martyrdom was again this tied in with the Eucharist in this way. So it says, I am the wheat of God. You know, when you have wheat and you need to make flour, you have to grind it up. So he says, let me be ground by the teeth of the wild beasts, that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. And he's saying, you know, that, you know, he says that, you know, while I am even now a servant, but when I suffer, I shall be the freedman of Christ and shall rise again emancipated. So he's saying that it's only by allowing his life to be a sacrifice in the way that called, that God has called him to sacrifice, which in his case is martyrdom. In our case, every case, every person's case is different. But in his case, his calling was to sacrifice you know, his life in martyrdom. And, you know, that is how then he's freed. Because, you know, Jesus Christ came to save us because we are enslaved to sin. That is why we are subject to death. We are subject to death, we are enslaved to sin. And Jesus Christ came to save us from that. So, you know, it's through his dying that then he becomes a freed man. He becomes emancipated. And to kind of, what does he say here? Yeah, so, then I shall truly be a disciple of Christ when the world shall not see so much as my body. So he's in his humility, even though he's a bishop, he's saying, you know, he's not really a disciple of Christ until he fulfills his calling in life, which is to be martyred. And so he's in his humility, he's saying he's not even a disciple of Christ. I think we could look at him and say, okay, you are a disciple of Christ already, St. Ignatius. But he's seeing himself as, you know, that he's sinful and that he needs to be complete the sacrifice to be freed of sin. So I don't know, any comments on all that? I know that was a lot in that paragraph. That's really some analogy though, huh? When he talks about the I'm the wheat of God. You know. It's
interesting that he says I won't be any trouble to anyone if, you know, they just dispose of me completely. Like he's trouble to someone now, right?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't want to cause any trouble.
So, to me, it seems like a model or modeling of dying to the world, being born in Christ, that your comment to Catherine about we're not literally expected to go to this extreme, but certainly this is the example of dying to the world. I mean, the extreme extrapolation of it.
Well, and yeah, I mean, and that's, it's like, at that time, it was almost thought of as, okay, the norm is to be a martyr. Maybe you won't be martyred, but it was almost like, you know, this kind of the normal thing that usually happens to Christians. But
it came with the office.
Yeah. it was part of the.
I left too much behind.
Part of the gang, yeah. Yeah. So I mean, it's kind of a, you know, yeah, it's a. But I agree. I mean, that's that we are called to martyrdom, in the sense of martyrdom simply meaning the word witness. And we're all called to witness Jesus Christ in our lives. We're all called to sacrifice our lives, but that doesn't mean that we're going to get eaten up by lions, as he does.
But we can be eaten by the world.
Yeah.
Or less than one.
And that would not be good.
Now, at this time, I believe the only people who became, quote, saints were martyrs. Correct?
And at some
point, that changed.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The martyr is still kind of the basic
model
of a saint.
Yeah.
And then even like when monasticism first started, you know, much of the reason why monasticism first started is because Christianity was getting more accepted and then eventually legalized. And so people weren't killing Christians all the time. So Christians had to figure out something else to do to make their lives really difficult. So they went and lived in a desert by themselves. You know,
some of the best writings are the Desert Fathers.
Yeah, and they had this same approach, of sacrifice and prayer, but it wasn't actual martyrdom in the sense of
this is. I digress, but. What's going through my mind in the least here is Jesus and Nicodemus meeting at night, you know, And almost the concluding remark of our Lord is, to Nicodemus is, that which is flesh is flesh. That which is spirit is spirit. You know, I mean, it goes with the sound of the wind and everything else, you know. And all that has ever done for me is simply made some things a little more confusing, you know. Just what is, you know, what is it? It's not a sufficient application for someone as dumb as I am. And then you sit there and you wonder, gee, you know, I better not let my friends know. I don't want them to see me.
Well, the scriptures are full of things that lots of us, none of us understand, I think. But yeah, I think like the flesh and spirit thing that he touches on, I think it's really, that's coming from the Gospel of John, I think, that language. And I think this actually helps explain it when he talks about what is seen and what is not seen. Here he has a line here, actually. So he says, you know, then I shall truly be a disciple of Christ, when the world shall not see so much as my body. If we think of the ending, towards the ending of the Gospel of Luke, there's this scene where after Jesus is resurrected, they're the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, right? Where they're on the road to Emmaus, Christ appears to them, they have a conversation, they don't recognize him. It's really strange, right? Really strange, they don't recognize him. They say they're going to stop for the night, they insist that he comes and eats with them. And then it says that he takes the bread, he blesses it, and then he breaks it. And when he breaks it, what happens?
He recognizes him.
And then what happens?
He disappears.
So that's actually what we're seeing here, right? He's saying that I shall truly be a disciple of Christ when the world shall not see so much as my body. He's saying that when I'm broken, right? Because he says the pure bread of Christ, he says when I'm broken, that's when I'm going to disappear. And then that's when he's truly a disciple of Christ. Yeah.
When he says that he is not as Peter and Paul, issuing commandments unto them, they were apostles, but I am a condemned man. Is he out of humility placing himself below the apostles? Like, don't take me too seriously, just let things happen?
Mm-hmm. There was, like, in the early church, they tried to really make a distinction of, like, who is an apostle and who's just one of their successors. That once they didn't keep using that term apostle to mean the leaders of the church, they started using the term bishop, and so they did have a very much a sense of like their superior and you know.
It just seems strange that it just popped in.
Yeah, but he's not, you know, he's not really giving them commandments.
No.
You know, he's kind of begging them in a sense.
Right.
please don't get in the way. Please don't prevent me from being martyred. But he's not telling them you can't, you know. Well, I guess, I mean, we're about halfway through. We could just continue with this next week because it's already been an hour. We're definitely not going to be able to finish today. Let me see if there's anything else here I want to mention. Yeah. Oh, it's kind of just that first sentence. That's kind of again, he's imitating Saint Paul. That you know that he writes to the churches, and even there's something interesting going on that he actually wrote 7 letters, and Saint Paul wrote. How many letters? I'm blanking. 14? 7. Forget. But yeah, it's just interesting that he's... this is what I was thinking. I'm sorry, not St. Paul. In Revelation, there are 7 letters. In the book of Revelation, there are 7 letters. And he wrote 7 letters. And so it's really... And he wrote 7 letters to 7 churches, basically. And so there's something going on there. I don't know what it is. But seven indicates, of course, from Genesis, seven is the sign of full completion. And so, you know, maybe he had this idea, you know, I need to write seven letters to kind of get out everything I need to say. But I don't know. I'm not sure what's going on, but
this part, Father, where he's so concerned about any part of his body being left that someone has to clean up and take care of, so different from afterwards when people were martyred. I mean, mm-hmm. the saints would go dig through the garbage to find their body parts and everything to bury them. And when did that differ? When did that change, or why did that change?
I think he's trying to make the point about the Eucharist more than anything else. Like I just said about this idea that, you know, Christ is known, you know, when in the breaking of the bread, he's known and then he disappears. And I think that's kind of the point he's trying to make more than anything else. And even in the sense that, you know, when we celebrate the Eucharist, at that time, everybody received in their hand, as the priest does still, and the deacon. And, you know, once you partake, then you don't see it anymore, right? But that's when that is the grace, the presence of Christ is through that action of partaking. And so it's interesting, you know, that it's kind of the same thing. You see it, and then you partake, and then you don't see it. But that's when Christ is present. So Christ is better known when you don't see him. It's a strange thing. And so he's kind of, I think that's the point he's trying to make. At that point, I don't know if they were I don't know if that idea of like relics had really started yet. I'm sure they preserved bodies and they buried people, but I don't think.
Well, so they would go through and they would, you know, like say go through garbage or ashes or whatever, give body parts to give them a decent burial, not necessarily to have them as relics in churches.
Yes, and they would even do that for non-Christians. The Christians would do that for non-Christians, just out of respect for the human body. Yeah, but especially for the martyrs.
You know, you think about what's happened up in Florida, you know, down there, and these people out there digging meticulous, you know, every little grain of sand practically, you know.
Yeah.
And
they did that with 9/11 too, with the towers.
You know, and but does it have to take a crisis situation for us to have that mindset? That's my problem. Why can't this be naturally a part of us, you know? Instead of emotions have to be played with, and this has to be drug out of a person.
And that's when we have respect for the human body.
Yeah.
Yeah. When there's a crisis. That's a good point. Yeah. Well, good. So I guess we'll continue the second half this next week. And if I passed out a copy to you, just keep it, or you can give it back to me and I can give it back to you if you lose it or whatever. So. Okay, Sarah, if you're ready, we could
Word to pay your tokos, sweet.